On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The country's been in an uproar over Walter Reed and the treatment of wounded U.S. soldiers coming home from Iraq. Meanwhile, 140,000 soldiers are still out there, still on the firing line, still on patrol, and more than ever right now in Baghdad, where President Bush's surge is focused, and lately in Baghdad's Sadr City, the Iraqi capital's vast and critical Shiite slum. ABC News reporter Martha Raddatz has put together the gripping story of when Sadr City first exploded in the face of U.S. troops. The New York Times' Damian Cave is still there on the streets today as the surge unfolds. Up next on Point, at the heart of it, the troops' eye view of Baghdad's Sadr City, then and now. We'll hear in a moment from ABC News Chief White House correspondent Martha Raddatz, whose powerful new book, The Long Road Home, is a blow-by-blow account of the day it all went bad in Baghdad's Sadr City. But joining me first from Iraq is Damian Cave, Baghdad correspondent for The New York Times. Damian Cave, thank you very much for being with us from Baghdad.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You know, there's so much talk about progress or lack thereof in Iraq, in particular Baghdad, in the U.S. today, with new reports out, signs going in several directions here. First of all, just big picture in the city, before we get into Sadr City in particular, what's your sense, Damian Cave, following it day in and day out, of how the surge is going? Is it having a positive impact?
Well, one of the things that's really interesting about Baghdad these days is that it's extremely segregated. So you do have neighborhoods where there are signs of improvement, and Sadr City is actually one of them. Generally, Shiite areas are beginning to revive, and there are signs of improvement. However, in many Sunni and mixed areas and contested areas, it's as bad or worse than it was several months ago. So it's really not so easy to get a broad overview and say, oh, well, this is doing well or not doing well. There are mixed signals in every category here, and both the Americans and the Iraqis are still trying to figure out exactly how things are going.
We'll pay particular attention to the Sunni side of that equation some today, but maybe on another day. On the Shiite side, it goes to Sadr City. Martha Raddatz has written about what a kind of horrible meat grinder that became a few years ago. Right now, what is the interpretation of why the Shiite militias led by Muqtada al-Sadr are not giving the U.S. troops a rougher reception in this great, big, and potentially very dangerous urban zone?
Well, there are a number of different factors that have been cited. One of them is that many members of the Mahdi army, the militia loyal to Sadr, have left the country or been arrested. At the same time, Sadr has appeared to crack down on some of his guys who he felt were disloyal. So there's generally been an element of purging that's been going on. And at the same time, they've been ordered to cooperate with the Americans. So you have an element of people saying that, listen, we're trying to become more of a community army. A lot of the folks that I've talked to in Sadr City have a very sophisticated public relations campaign that basically says, we are not a militia, we are a group of volunteers trying to help people here. So they have put out this message, and this is something that they're trying very hard to get people to believe. And at this point, you know, whether or not this is actually the case, there are signs that there have been less violence committed by these people. So it's just a question of whether or not they're doing this sincerely or they're doing it in an effort to wait out the American troops who are here and perhaps seize power at a greater level after or if the Americans withdraw.
And how can we read the oracle bones on that? How does it look? Anthony Cordesman was saying in Washington, days ago, that if the U.S. goes in and cleans this up, the Shiite, it will mean ultimately Shiite dominance. How's the U.S. military reading it? Shiites lying low with the program?
I mean, the government is already significantly Shiite-led. And, you know, there are thoughts that this will have as they want. But Sadr City is a really complicated place. I mean, it's a place that was in war for decades under Saddam Hussein. And as there have been signs of it reviving, there is a sense among some people there that, well, hey, the benefits of being in charge, the benefits of cooperating with government, you can see in your daily life. And so there is an element of possibly a changing attitude among some people. It's hard to get an idea of how many people. But it's not entirely. There are arguments on sides saying that, well, it's extremely cynical, but there are also arguments suggesting that it's a sincere change of heart by some people in the neighborhood.
A lot turning on this one very large, very influential, important neighborhood, a longtime slum, really beaten up badly under Saddam Hussein, many Shiites there, and U.S. troops, the last time around, had a pretty tough time of it there. Damien Cave in Baghdad, please stand by for a moment. I want to welcome into our conversation with me now in the studio is Martha Raddatz, Chief White House Correspondent for ABC News, former Pentagon Correspondent for NPR, we should say. Her new book is The Long Road Home, A Story of War and Family, and it is really a gripping story indeed. Martha Raddatz, thanks very much for being with us.
It's great to be here, Tom.
We're going to look at what you put together from that sort of fateful day, that fateful time in 2004 when it just blew apart at the seams. But before we do, look out from your Washington perspective now. When you cover the White House, when they look at what's going on out there, how do they say, relief at the end of this thing? Is it finally turning their way? Or is this, one more example of us being led to hope for something better and then we've got, bloody chaos again?
I think what they think is it's the last best chance in Baghdad. And you've got this surge going on. But as Damien points out, there are several ways to look at this. There are several ways to say, well, are they just lying low? Are they waiting to come out again? Are the Shiites just saying, look, if we stand back for a while, then people will blame the Sunnis for all the violence, and that's okay with us. So I think there are several ways to look at this. As you might imagine, at the White House, they're saying, well, Muqtada al-Sadr is coming back into the political fold. I mean, I feel like at the White House, because of my national security background, I can say, excuse me, Mr. Snow, is that necessarily a good sign? Because also, as Damien points out, they're following the Hezbollah model over there. Muqtada al-Sadr, during their first original battle over there, turned off the electrical grid and blamed it on the Americans. Mm-hmm. And 3 days later said, look, we just turned on the power that the Americans shot apart. So he
so
is
sort of the public servant
wily.
Model here that he may be using.
Exactly. And I think overall over there, the big concern is whether the Maliki government wants the same end state as the U.S. does. The U.S. wants a government that involves all parties, the Sunnis, the Shiites, everyone. Whether al-Maliki wants that is still in question. Whether he just wants the Shiites to dominate in the end, that is what they have to watch.
But might that outcome become tempting for the White House? I mean, maybe they wanted everyone in there, but if that just means all-out civil war, might the White House now welcome super Shiite dominance, let them have their own civil war, but U.S. troops out?
I think that's certainly something they've looked at in the past. But when you look at Iraq, you can't forget the rest of the world. The Shiites may be the dominant majority there, but that is not the case worldwide. When you look at Muslim communities, you have got Sunni dominance.
Damien Cave, do you see or might there be seen a formula here for super Shiite dominance as painting an exit for the U.S.?
It's really hard to tell. I mean, from the American side, talk of an exit is just not something that's in their playbook at this point here. And it's really, I mean, I think it depends on stability. I mean, if you can create a country in which people can once again go to the market freely without fear for their lives, as opposed to slipping behind blast walls that are now put up all around the markets, then it's possible to imagine a scenario in which the Americans decide that this is enough and perhaps it's time to go. Stability, it seems, at this point is such a difficult goal to attain that that's the first priority, it seems. And at that and beyond that point, is anyone's guess what the policies would be or what would be acceptable?
Take us back into the streets of Sadr City for a minute. We'll hear Martha describe what it was like in 2004 when troops rolled in and it just fell apart. But today, in the surge, which has gone back into Sadr City now, what kind of reception, Damien Cave, and how are U.S. troops operating there?
They're actually getting quite a warm reception by Iraqi standards. I mean, people are letting them come into their homes. There have been few shots fired. Basically, this is in part a large part a result of negotiations that the Americans have been involved in with the mayor in Sadr City, other Iraqi officials, over the role of the Mahdi Army and the role of the Americans as they come in. So it's a place that's changing. It's a place in transition. There are a lot of reconstruction projects that are booming there. Residents say that it's improving. Rents have gone up. Businesses are opening. And this is something that one of the deputy mayor in Baghdad told me that he hopes that when the Americans come in, they don't ruin Sadr City's new curbs. So there's an element of trying to protect some of the burgeoning stability that's there, and that's a piece of it. But, you know, there are also risks there that have not died down. It's just they may, you know, completely. So the Americans are still very cautious. When I was there a couple of weeks ago, unembedded, meeting with the mayor and talking to some people, American troops were searching homes, but they were also very cautious not to stand in the middle of the street for fear of snipers. So it's not a place that's felt to be entirely safe at this point, but it does seem to be changing.
Martha Raddatz, you look closely at 2004, but you've been in Iraq a dozen times, and only last month, most recently. I mean, you've seen how this place went from seemingly calm to chaos before.
Yeah, and I think that's what you really have to watch here. I think, and Damien's there right now, I am not, but I think the areas that the U.S. troops are going in have been relatively stable in Sadr City. They're not going into the nastiest parts of Sadr City yet, so that's going to be a real test there. The other thing is, over my years of going back and forth, and I try always to go into Sadr City, is you see things improve. There was one period of time a couple of years ago where they were getting the sewage cleaned up, a lot of reconstruction progress, and then it falls apart again.
Martha Raddatz, take us back 2004, March 4th. Sadr City had been calm. In come this, First Cavalry crew of soldiers just fresh into Iraq, never seen combat before. What did they think they were coming into? What did they find in Sadr City?
In Sadr City, hard to imagine, but in the year prior, before the 1st Cavalry Division got there, only one soldier had been killed. So the 1st Cavalry Division was prepared for a peacekeeping mission. Didn't bring all their tanks, didn't bring all their Bradleys, because you don't want to go into the streets and tanks and expect to win hearts and minds. Just in from Fort Hood, Texas. They're based there. Soldiers were coming from all over the country where their families lived, but based in Fort Hood, Texas, had been in Iraq 4 days. And the very day this battalion took command, literally at the hour they took command, a platoon came under fire. You had 19 soldiers pinned down, an Iraqi interpreter, four Humvees. Two of them were completely destroyed. They had to take refuge in an alley and call for help. Now, just imagine, I mean, their communications gear wasn't all set up. They were basically had no GPS. They were just following paper maps in their Humvees.
And they just got in to clean up the streets to work on some sewage issues.
They were trying to do exactly what they're still trying to do today. They were trying to suck up some sewage and make life better for the people there, and that's when they came under fire. And literally, Tom, thousands of Mahdi militia and civilians hit the streets and a fierce, fierce firefight. So then back at the base, soldiers were jumping into rescue vehicles, open trucks. I mean, just the most vulnerable. Anything at hand. And by the end of that evening, on their very first day of taking over, they had 8 soldiers dead, and they had more than 70 wounded. And the book goes back and forth to the families at home getting the word and what happened on the streets. It's basically 1 week in Iraq. What happened during that 1 week, particularly this one battle?
It's an absolutely harrowing story. And if you want to feel some reality-based empathy for what soldiers have been up against there, it is really something to read. Martha, I wish you would read a little bit of it for us. Here we are, they get pinned down in this alleyway. This has not been exactly hostile territory, but suddenly they've got mobs of people descending on them. We should set up for us and then read. And it's a pretty good chunk here, but listeners, I really think it's worth it to feel the drama and the cost and the moral decisions put in front of these soldiers in extreme duress. Martha, set it up for us and read if you would.
Okay, they are in the alley, and Shane Awero, who is the platoon leader, is standing in the alley, and it's about 10 feet wide. They have 2 Humvees left. They have one on the right side of him, one on the left side of him, kind of blocking the alley. And
this is deep in Sadr City, slum there.
It's getting dark, and Awero looks out. He says, to Awero, the most horrifying aspect of what he was watching unfold was that the Mahdi militiamen had put women and children at the front of the advancing horde. Behind them came young men in civilian clothes, many armed with AK-47s, and behind them row after row of Mahdi militiamen, dressed in black, their weapons pointed at the Humvees. Next came the elderly men and women waving flags and banners, shouting, Muqtada, Muqtada. Jassim, the platoon's Iraqi interpreter, shouted to the crowds in Arabic, imploring the women and kids at the front, if you go back, you won't get hurt. They didn't listen. The men in civilian clothes began firing on the Humvees directly over the heads of the children. The militiamen shot at the Americans on the roof. As the firing continued, the mob pressed closer and closer. Aguero and his soldiers were growing increasingly frustrated. They could not fire accurately back at the militiamen without hitting the children in front. But at some point, the Americans would have to defend themselves. Aguero calculated that once the crowds approaching from Route Delta got within 50 feet of his platoon, his men would no longer be able to stop them. There would be too many people, too close. Aguero drew an imaginary line in the alley about 50 yards beyond his current position and waited. When the front rank of the crowd crossed the line, Aguero started shooting into the crowd. His soldiers, having held their fire until that point, joined in. Aguero had set his M4 rifle on a 3-round burst, meaning a single pull of the trigger would fire 3 rounds. He set his aim at 4 feet off the ground, trying to avoid the children and hit the militiamen in their upper torsos. Within seconds, he emptied a 30-round magazine. Aguero hated firing, knowing that kids could be hit, and he knew his men felt the same way. These people are so stupid, he thought. It was unimaginable to him that someone would intentionally put children in harm's way, and he wished he and his men could be more discriminating. But it was all happening too fast. The gunmen in the crowd kept firing relentlessly, advancing all the while. The burst setting tended to lift the muzzle of his rifle, sending the rounds too high. The first shot would be accurate, the second would hit about a foot above the aim point, and the third would inevitably miss. So Aguero set his weapon on semi-automatic, dropped the sight level to 3 feet, and fired off another 5 or 6 magazines. If they don't care about their own children, he told himself, I don't care either. Aguero knew he had to protect his platoon. Jassim, the Iraqi interpreter, and Specialist Carl Weil had taken positions a few feet from Sergeant Fisk's position in the Humvee, and they were now firing on the crowd as well. Jassim was using Sergeant Chen's weapon. Sergeant Chen lay dead inside. Once the militia started shooting at him and the Americans he was with, the interpreter didn't hesitate to return fire. The gunfire from the platoon was now constant, the soldiers following a well-practiced routine. Look through the gun sight, acquire a target, fire until the target drops. Scan and acquire another target, fire until it drops. Repeat until it's time to reload. Hurry, hurry. The soldiers were now firing in both directions at the crowd approaching from the west as well as the people marching in from Route Delta. The Americans' most damaging fire was coming from the big guns mounted on the Humvees and the machine guns on the rooftop. Each round from a 50 cal could penetrate at least 4 bodies, and the M240 was capable of slicing through yards of flesh and bone with a single shot. Sergeant Eric Borquin launched 2 grenades, and the fragments ricocheted off walls and through the alleyway at dizzying speed. In little more than 30 seconds, the platoon went through more than 3,000 rounds. In barely a minute, the gunfight was over. Aguero and his men stopped firing and stared, stunned. It was surreal. A tangle of bodies lay in the street, some on top of one another, a cloud of acrid smoke curling over them. Aguero estimated there were at least 100 dead, including children, stretching back over a distance of about 50 yards. Slowly at first and then more quickly, townspeople and militiamen began collecting the bodies, dragging them by the legs or under the arms, leaving trails of blood in the street.
Martha Raddatz, reading from her new book, The Long Road Home, that scene put together from many, many interviews with those who were there, powerful in many directions.
And Tom, I have to say one thing. I would not have known about this. I would not have known about this scene. Shane Aguero told me about this without hesitation. And it was one of the things that happened with this book. The 1st Cavalry Division said, you tell the story, good, bad, whatever. Shane Aguero was a father of 2 young children himself.
Looking at those Iraqi children in the streets of Saddam City.
And feeling horrified. But all these soldiers said, it was kill or be killed.
You wouldn't have known. We wouldn't have known. There's so much we don't know here. Damien Cave, you're listening in generously from Baghdad there with that kind of history. This is not so long ago. 100 bodies just on that one day in the street, including children. I mean, will the Shiites of Sadr City forgive? Do they forgive Americans for that kind of interaction? Is it boiling sort of underground resentment? Was this just one bad day?
Well, one point that I think Martha made, which was smart and correct, is that, you know, this is a neighborhood that listens to what it's told by Muqtada al-Sadr. And if at any point he decided that he wanted to fight again, they would take up arms. And there have been times when I've been doing interviews there where there's a wave of anger that comes out of a group of people as they describe the Americans as the cause of every problem here in Iraq. And so it's clear that there is still a lot of anger there and that this is definitely a possibility. One of the things that Martha also pointed out, which is true, is that Sadr City is an enormous place. It's roughly half the size of Manhattan, and there are neighborhoods that are better or worse or, you know, more willing to cooperate and less willing to cooperate. One of the concerns, in fact, for the Americans was that they would raid a house or have a problem in one house that would then create a block-wide little battle, even if the people who were fighting were militiamen who were not listening to the senior commanders. It could be enough of a damage to start a small conflict or a major clash even in a small block area within this larger neighborhood.
So the volatility still right there. We've got a lot of people listening, and a bunch of them want to join the conversation. Let me turn to Mohammed, calling from Weymouth, Massachusetts. Mohammed, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
I'm well. What do you think? What do you hear, Mohammed?
Yeah, I mean, I am coming across a very odd political term, that Shia-dominated government, and the talk about Sadr City. Let me correct something.
Do you know Sadr City, Mohammed?
Yeah, I am from Sadr City myself, and I mean, I have, like, so much. I'm really troubled with the way of reporting that justification of a massacre. Your guess is exactly what she's doing.
I hope she's not presenting it as a justification, but
she is. This is my personal opinion.
Okay.
The way she painted is totally like that. And the other thing is, one of the things she claimed that Shiite militia turned off the electricity. Man, the electricity in Baghdad is the worst ever you could imagine.
Yes, I am well aware of that. Believe me, well aware of that.
So when you say they shut off the electricity for 3 days, then they turn it off, this is a misleading statement.
But the notion that the Mahdi army is positioning itself to be both military and social service, that's pretty clear, isn't it, Mohammed?
If they shut down whatever electricity they had, which they did.
Let me tell you some other facts about Sadr City.
Yes, please.
Which is totally oppressed by the regime. Saddam regime, and American policy, instead of winning the people who were oppressed by the regime, they, since day one of occupation, they start arresting people. One of the events you don't mention or you never reported, the taking off the flag, the Shiite flag, by a helicopter, for no reason, just to aggravate people and insult their faith or religion. So the American is not the, I'm not talking about the soldier, I'm talking about the policymaker and the reporters as well. They didn't do anything positive to win the people in Sadr City, the other way around. And why people in Sadr City think American even cooperating with the terrorists to hurt the Shiites, I will tell you why. Because the minute the American besieged Sadr City, the next day after they left this besiege, 250 people from Sadr City get slaughtered. So people...
By Sunnis, that, you're saying? By Sunnis?
By Al-Qaeda and extreme Sunni. And people, common sense analysis, would say, okay, why whenever the Americans show up, we have a car bombing?
Mohammed, let me just ask you this. Do you see a possibility now, with the new surge, for Sadr City to become a building block of new stability, or not?
I think it's a joke, because the terrorists, the people who are killing Americans, are not the people in Sadr City, unless Al-Qaeda is located in Sadr City. So it's really the reporters are very, very, I don't know why they do that, or if they have a kind of arrogant intellectual way of analyzing things.
Who do you think killed the Americans on April 4th, 04?
Man, April 4th, you got 100 people get slaughtered, and the people I talked to, they already have a suspicion about America. They didn't come in a clear planning. They didn't notify people in the city. They didn't get the elderly, the people who are in power. They didn't even care whether there are people there who are afraid of the American. They don't know what they want to do or not. So it was a mismanagement, but the one who paid the price are the people in Sadr City. Not like your book is stating, that if they don't care for their children, how the hell we could care for them. And this is a very, very negative and sad statement to hear it on the national public radio.
Mohammed, we've got your perspective very clearly, and we appreciate it. I should say, Martha, there you're reporting what that soldier felt at that moment with his platoon under
Mohammed,
fire.
I am, Mohammed, and I also want to say to you, you have some very good points. And for instance, the helicopter and the flag, that I do talk about that in the book, and that was something that incited the population and the closing of the newspaper by Paul Bremer a few days before mm-hmm. this happened. It was a terrible convergence of events. I know the reconstruction was not going well. I know some of the attitudes there are just like you say, electricity is horrible in Iraq now. It's worse than it was before the invasion. And I do think there are a lot of people there who expected the Americans to come in and solve those problems quickly, and they didn't.
But a massacre? I mean, when 100 are dead,
I'm clearly telling this from the perspective of the U.S. soldiers and what they said. And this is what they saw. This is from their perspective. There's no question about it. I think if you read this, you'll see a lot of the things that led up to this day and why it happened. But this is a book about soldiers and their families. And in many cases, you can't really go into Sadr City and interview Muqtada al-Sadr and his followers. Mm. I can tell you that.
Damien Cave, what about today? I mean, we can hear exactly how hard this is for anyone to listen to, in particular, like Mohammed from Sadr City. Mohammed, full empathy to the way this must hit your ears. At the same time, it was very tough for U.S. soldiers. When they go back into Sadr City today, Damien Cave, what kind of attitudes do you see them carrying with them?
I mean, it's hard to tell. Some of these units are not necessarily the same units who were there in 2004, but like all soldiers here, or many soldiers here, they're there to do a job, and that's the approach that they have. I mean, you don't get the sense that they are nursing grudges. They're there to clear the houses, to look for weapons, to try and make it safe, and they believe that that's what they're trying to do. But there is, I mean, one of the things that Mohammed raised is that there is a legacy of pain and frustration and anger on both sides, which is the nature of war. I mean, it's one of the things that's a big question here is, how do you heal a place that's seen this much death and destruction? How do you bring it back together when you have so much frustration and anger? And that's still an open question. And this event in Sadr City several years ago is just one of many wounds here that have yet to heal.
I just jump in here that say the 1st Cavalry Division, which is the division that was there on April 4th, 2004, mm. is back. They are, in fact, in Sadr City, and many of the same people are back.
Mm. Sherry is calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Sherry. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Boy, Martha, I have to say that story just made my stomach, my insides hurt.
Yeah.
It's just
not
awful.
Kidding.
It's very difficult to read.
I just have to say that I'm a total pacifist. I hated this war. Can't stand President Bush. But we started the thing. We brought that in there, and I just think we have to try and finish it. And it's the hardest thing for me to say in the world, but now that we're in there, I mean, we brought this mess.
What does finish it mean for you now, Sherry?
I don't know if we can finish it. That's the whole thing. I don't know if anything's going to work, but it just seems like there's probably no good alternative. I don't know. It's such a mess.
But you know what you're doing, Sherry, which is great, and which I hope all Americans do, is to think about it. And no matter what your politics are or how you feel about us getting into the war or where it's going, is to think about consequences of whatever you decide you believe should be done there. And I think those who want to withdraw the troops need to think about what that would mean exactly. Those who want to leave them there should think about how long they would be there. Is there success? That I think this country has to elevate the debate about this war and figure out, not in a political environment, and I say that knowing that is impossible, but to have a deep debate about where this is going, what should happen, and exactly what you say. We are there now. That is the attitude of the troops on the ground, believe me. It is. They don't think a whole lot about the politics about this in the debate. They say, we are here. We have to do what we have to do.
Mm. Sherry, thank you for calling. Let me get another call from Saranac Lake, New York. David, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I was going to commend everybody's attention. I'm sure Martha has read it. I think Tom has actually had the individual on who wrote Fiasco, Our American Military Adventure.
Tom Ricks, my friend, he blurbs Martha Raddatz's book here, shows how Americans' troops sweat, bleed, and fight in the Iraq War. Read it. Thomas Ricks' word here.
okay, I think it was a wonderful book, but one of the things he brings up is that we keep talking about strategy and not policy. I compare our situation in Iraq to someone caught in quicksand, and the more you struggle to get out of quicksand, the deeper you get, especially if you violently try to struggle. I believe the surge is going to fail because that is the proper analogy. We have to slowly but surely withdraw. It's really like being in quicksand.
Damien Cave, let us bring that one to you. The Iraqi government has been saying just in the last 24 hours that things are better since the surge began. American military commanders, as you and others report, a little more careful in how they characterize what's going on. Does it feel like a struggle? Does it feel like a slow road, but at least a road out? Or, what do you say to Dave, who says, don't struggle, just, you know, get out?
I mean, it's really hard to tell kind of where things are at this point. I mean, there have been several security plans in the past that had initially positive reports that then turned out to be not nearly as good as they hoped or not nearly as successful. But the thing that I would encourage people to think about, or one of the things that I think you realize when you're here, is that, you know, Iraqis, there's a lot of Iraqis here who are affected by the policy, and it's not just about the politics at home that matters. You know, there are people who, you know, brave life and death just to go to the market, to go shopping, and there are lots of people here who have suffered more than a lot of people at home. And the question is that, you know, how do you fix this, and how do you help these people, and would pulling out, you know, leave them to, you know, complete and imminent death and hundreds of thousands of people? It's hard to tell, but that's a tough question that, you know, I hope that people do think about at home. It's something that, you know, I know we think about a lot here, and as distant as Washington is, I hope it's something, and I'm sure it is, that people are thinking about there as well.
Consequences.
It's not just about the troops.
Let's go to Williamsburg, Virginia, and Vicky. Hi, Vicky. You're on the air with Martha Raddatz and Damien Cave.
Hi, how are you?
Well.
Good. My question is, I would like to know what Martha Raddatz thinks will happen when the U.S. pulls out.
I guess, I mean, I have heard a lot of opinions on that, Vicky, and I'm going to sound like Damien here, too, but we don't have any answers. We don't. I have heard from commanders that they think it will be an absolute bloodbath there. And they say, is America ready to see another Srebrenica, reference to Bosnia? That they believe it will descend into civil war even further, that they believe the region will then be affected by this. Now, whether that's true, we don't know. But those are the kind of things I think people have to hear, all sides of this. I do know that many commanders I have spoken to fear the worst if the troops pull out.
If they pull out soon, but there's got to be a
pull out soon,
someday, or does there? I mean,
well,
is it a bloodbath whenever?
Yeah, yeah. I think one of the things I've heard from some people I respect is that if we just let it simmer, if we just make sure it doesn't boil over into out of control, that might last for 10 years, it might last for 12 years, but that would solve the problem. Who knows? I mean, if you study counterinsurgency, go ahead,
Damien.
Is that, you know, among Iraqis, there seems to be agreement that if and when the Americans do pull out, there will be a spike in violence. It's just a question of how long it will last and to what degree it will be, and the question is how willing will the Iraqis and the Americans be to put up with that. And it is obviously still an open question, but it seems that there isn't really anyone here who I've spoken to who feels that things will not get worse. Among, you know, Iraqis, this is Iraqi opinion, if the Americans do pull out anytime soon. In 10 years, well, that's a different question.
Can the surge go on forever? I mean, a month ago, we were seeing, 1,400 attacks? I can't remember the metrics here, Damien Cave, but I mean, there's a lull a bit, maybe, right now, but we've seen the violence so high that talk of a bloodbath, if we withdrew, almost sounded like more of the same instead of worse.
Well, that's a valid point. I mean, one of the things that's questionable is how much of a footprint the Americans really have. I mean, as Baghdad violence has decreased by some metrics, violence has increased in areas just outside of Baghdad. So is overall violence in Iraq down? It's not clear to anyone if that's the case. You know, Iraq is a big country. For every street that there's an American soldier on, there are 10 streets where someone can shoot someone or pull them and throw them in the back of a car without anyone noticing. It's a difficult place to police.
And the question is, certainly there would not be as many American lives if we pulled out, if any, but the Iraqi lives. And we would be leaving the Iraqis to fend for themselves, essentially. And the danger is, of course, whether the army, whether the police are Shiite controlled.
Let's go to Atlanta, Georgia, and Jim. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
We're okay. What do you think, Jim?
Well, listen, I was really saddened by the story of the firefight in Sadr City, but I was much more incensed by the term of the American massacre. If these, you know, these savages put their children and their babies out in front of their militia, well, what do they expect in advance trying to kill Americans? What result would logically come to mind?
Now, I want to parse carefully here. I don't think Martha used the word massacre. It comes up, though, when people discussed it. Muhammad called in very unhappy with what happened there. We're trying to figure out, you know, how do you describe these things? 100 or more dead in the street, including a lot of children.
And this is the oldest weapon of war in the streets in urban combat. I mean, they did that in Mogadishu, and I think all these young soldiers in that alley, they all had flashbacks, and they all said, this is a bad movie. This is like Mogadishu. No, and when they saw those children...
I did not hear Martha use it, but Tom, you did several times, and I think to characterize it that way does our people a gross disservice.
Yeah, I'm trying to see it, I guess, in its fullness. I mean, if you look at it at some level from the Iraqi, if you looked in that alleyway with Iraqi eyes after it happened, I don't know what you call it, but massacre might come to mind. On the other hand, you're right, the children were right out front, and Martha describes a sort of moral hell that was for the soldiers as they faced that.
And again, the soldiers told me this story. Yep. The soldiers did not have to tell me this story.
But, Jim, when you say those savages, where are you going with that? I mean, these are people. They've got families that they feel, I don't know, trespassed
on. They put their families out in front of the militia. I mean,
let's be clear here, though. The children did not put themselves out in front in many cases.
Absolutely,
I mean, we're
not.
Still talking
no,
about children.
I mean, it's they were being used as shields. That's what they were being used as. And whoever went down that alley with children in front were assuming the Americans wouldn't kill those children, or were assuming they'd look very bad afterwards if they did.
But it was clear they were ready to kill the Americans over the heads of those kids.
I mean, they were shooting the whole time they came down that alley. The soldiers really held off until they felt they couldn't do it anymore.
Jim, we've got your perspective loud and clear. I think part of the value of this book for me is, Martha, that you've brought front and center the kind of moral horror show situations that American soldiers have been required many, many times in Iraq to face, and we seldom do sitting
at
this great
distance. I mean, war
distance.
Is not clinical. It is not. There are lots of decisions. There are lots of horrors that these men and women face, and Iraqis face as well. But this is from the perspective of what it is like on the ground.
And
the U.S. soldiers.
And I should say, I mean, there's some amazing detail about the soldiers themselves here. You described Colonel Robert Abrams, and this is the son of General Creighton Abrams, of Vietnam War fame, the man for whom the Abrams tank is named. Here his son is. He's going to be looking over this entire 1st Cav, I guess, was
his
role.
His brigade.
There.
He had the brigade,
his brigade there. 21 years of service Colonel Abrams has had never... once heard a gun fired in battle before this incident blew up, never seen a soldier wounded in combat or watched a soldier die, and suddenly thrust into this intense cauldron.
He saw it all that night.
And there's another story here of Major General Peter Chiarelli, if
Corelli,
I got that
Corelli,
right.
Corelli, Major General, yep.
Okay, commanding general of the 1st Cavalry Division, just crushed by the American deaths and wounded he saw on that day, and I was fascinated. You write that he felt his emotions were too raw to turn to his wife Beth back in Fort Hood, Texas. Instead, he called, of all people, if you follow the news, he called General Eric Rick Shinseki, mentor and friend of Chiarelli. Of course, this was the guy who said, we're going to need hundreds of thousands of American soldiers in the aftermath of any invasion. The guy who was sort of shot down, poo-pooed by then Defense Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz. Here you've got General Chiarelli calling him up and in tears on the phone with an older general looking for solace after this day somewhere.
It was an amazing scene. He walked outside the tent after he heard they'd lost 8 soldiers, and General Chiarelli, who is an emotional man, and he's already been back in Baghdad for another year as well, and General Shinseki did not pick up the phone. It was a message, and General Chiarelli just broke down crying on it and said, we lost 8 kids. I later talked to General Shinseki, who does not like to be interviewed or even approached by the press, but he said that's exactly the way it happened. I'll never forget that phone call.
And he finally called him back and said, I know how shook up you are, Pete. Stay strong. That helped, but wow.
At the end of the year that the 1st Cavalry Division was there, they lost 168 soldiers. And there is a memorial that I visited this week in Fort Hood, Texas, with those names. And what is most chilling about that memorial is they have lots of granite slabs that are blank.
Waiting.
And as I said, the 1st Cavalry Division is back. General Corelli, I have to say, was one of those people who strongly believes in Reconstruction, who more than anything wanted to get those sewage areas cleaned up and the water running, and really focused on that. He is not a kick down the door kind of guy, and this battle broke his heart.
Damien Cave, now when the soldiers are in the streets, what exactly are they doing? Is it all fixing the curbs? We see pictures of them still going into homes. Are they finding weapons in Sadr City? Are they really cleaning out the militia, or has the militia moved itself out?
Oh, I mean, they are clearing homes. How many weapons they're finding, it's not clear how many. It doesn't seem to be the large caches that you might expect given the history there. But it's interesting. I mean, some of the Mahdi militiamen who I've interviewed at times, there's a mixed opinions of whether or not they're sort of becoming legitimized, getting normal jobs, or, some guys I've talked to have said that they're looking forward to not fighting, and other guys have said, I can't wait to kill all the Sunnis again after the Americans leave. So it's a large organization. I mean, the militia that is in Sadr City is in some argue it's disorganized, others argue that it's very, very tough. It's clear that there's a wide diversity of opinion, and that's what the Americans face. I mean, again, these are guys who don't wear uniforms, and so it's very difficult to tell as they go in here if the group of guys on the corner are, friend or foe, and that's the ongoing challenge every day that they go in there.
Martha Raddatz, you've helped us see the Iraqi scene there, the scene faced by American soldiers there. Take us back to Fort Hood for just a minute, and it's about all we've got, a couple here, to the families who waited on that day, and I'm sure many days since, as their husbands and brothers and sons were in the streets.
Well, you just brought up Colonel Abrams. Let's go back to Connie Abrams, who was back in Fort Hood and woke up that morning 9 hours ahead. His wife had just barely said goodbye to her, and she's home with their son. They think it's a peacekeeping mission, and she goes about her day. She goes to the officers' club for lunch. The others go to church, and then she starts getting phone calls and saying, Connie, we've been in a battle, and we have 2 dead, then 4 dead, then 6 dead throughout that day. And to gather that community together and see how they functioned, that sisterhood, they call it, at Fort Hood, and to help the families of those who were wounded and killed, not knowing for hours whether their own husbands were wounded or killed in this battle, is extraordinary. They shared as intimate details as you can imagine. I mean, the wife of one of those soldiers killed told me how she had lifted the pant legs of her husband when his body came home, that she just didn't believe it was him. Unbuttoned his shirt, just couldn't. He looked so much smaller, she said. So it is a very intimate portrayal of the families and what they have sacrificed as well.
Well, it is a chilling story, a story that leads to a kind of more informed empathy. And I hope that goes right across the board to the Iraqis involved
as
well.
It does, and I know the soldiers have that empathy.
At the end of the day, it's got to work somehow on all sides. Damien Cave, I want to thank you first in Baghdad for joining us this hour. It's been great to round it out with what's going on now. We're grateful to you, Damien. Thank you very much for being here.
Sure, my pleasure.
Damien Cave, New York Times correspondent in Baghdad, and Martha Raddatz, the new book is The Long Road Home. Martha, thanks for all your work on this. Thanks for your many reports from Iraq and from Washington. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks. It was great being here. Thanks.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.